Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This hour, as coronavirus cases surge, the Philadelphia School District has decided not to bring some students into school buildings November 30th. School Superintendent William Hite will join us in just a bit. And can't believe we're here already, but we're halfway through football season. Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist Marcus Hayes will give us his take on the Eagles and their chances. But first, contact tracing is a critical and often thankless job. And in Philadelphia, where coronavirus cases are spiking, pressure is intensifying to connect and communicate with the increasing number of people who have tested positive, many of whom are often reluctant to talk. To start the show, we'll discuss the city's plan to ease the burden on contact tracers, as well as the challenges in doing effective contact tracing, the calls that are never answered, the respondents who refuse to be interviewed, and the urgency to do successful outreach while managing bigger caseloads as we enter an increasingly dangerous phase of the pandemic. WHYY's Michaela Winberg has been following this story for Billy Penn, and she's here with us now on the Regional Roundup. Welcome back, Michaela.
Good morning, Mary. How you doing?
Well, thanks. Contact tracers are frontline workers in the battle against the virus. Let's begin by getting a quick refresher about, exactly what this job entails.
Sure. Yeah, like you said, contact tracers are sort of frontline employees. They are the city employees who are responsible for limiting the spread of coronavirus by letting people know that they might have been exposed recently. So basically, they spend their day calling people who have already tested positive for the virus and getting a list of places they've been, people they've seen, things they've done around the time they tested positive. And then they reach out to those people, those contacts, and let them know, hey, you came in contact with someone who tested positive, so you should get tested. And in the meantime, you should quarantine depending on the results that you get.
And how many does the city have on staff?
As of last month, there were 122. So we're somewhere in the ballpark of 120 contact tracers on staff.
So again, what are the primary challenges contact tracers are facing right now as the pandemic intensifies?
Yeah, there are quite a few. First of all, they've had this long-standing problem. They've constantly had to deal with this phenomenon of people not wanting to answer their calls or answering their calls, but then declining to be interviewed for whatever reason. And lately, as we've seen coronavirus cases rise in the region and across the country, there's a really big capacity issue. So we just don't have enough contact tracers to reach everyone who've tested positive and certainly not all their contacts.
You spoke with, I believe her name's pronounced Denise Argurto. Do I have that right?
Agurto, yeah.
She works as a contact tracer for the Philadelphia Health Department. How does she describe her days, Michaela?
Denise is swamped, just like all the contact tracers. So she is a Spanish language contact tracer, and she sort of described the process to me. Each case requires a 20-minute interview, and if people don't answer on the first try, then she has to follow up at least once or a couple times. So usually a regular day for her a few months ago, she would have 10 to 15 calls a day, which would fill her plate. And last Tuesday, I talked to her on Wednesday, she said she had to juggle 25 calls. So obviously that's a huge jump. That's making her day a lot busier. She said that she has this 8-person department of Spanish language contact tracers. Usually half of them will do interviews and half of them will follow up on the contacts that they get from those interviews. But with their workload growing the way it is, with cases rising, half of that staff has had to start doing both. They're interviewing and tracking down contacts. So they're just swamped right now.
And do tracers at times have to make tough decisions, say choose whom to reach out to first and, whom to get to if at all possible?
Yeah. Yeah, that's begun to be a phenomenon in Philly's contact tracing unit. Contact tracers have to now concentrate on people in long-term care facilities or nursing homes. They concentrate on schools and daycares because those are places where there are a lot of people, a lot of staff who can all sort of contract the virus really quickly if it spreads. So they prioritize these sort of high-risk settings right now because they can't get to everyone.
So back to screening calls. I don't know about you, but I do spend a lot of time screening calls. And if I don't recognize the number, I don't pick up. A big issue, obviously, for contact tracers, as you alluded to earlier. How is the city, trying to work around this?
During the last week of October, During the last week of October, 11% of people who the Philly contact tracers tried to reach were either unable to be reached because they didn't answer or they declined to be interviewed. So that's a huge problem for them.
So, you know, say a person tests positive. How do they know the call they get is from a legitimate contact tracer?
Yeah, there are a few ways that you can know for sure, which I think will be really helpful for people to answer and to not think this is a scam. So yeah. The first thing is you'll probably get a text first from a contact tracer and they'll say, hey, I'm going to give you a call soon. I'm a contact tracer from the Philadelphia government. So you can expect that text. And the call will come from a phone number that starts 215-218. So I'll say that again. That's 215-218. And the last four digits will depend just on the extension of the employee who's calling you. And if you really do want to screen the call, if you see that number, you can let it go to voicemail and they'll leave you a callback number.
Okay, that's fair. So, you know, what if somebody who's calling, what if you think it is a contact tracer and they ask for you know, really personal information like a social security number? Is that to be expected during these calls?
Definitely not. No, if you get someone who calls themselves a contact tracer and they're asking you for a social security number, for financial information, banking information, then that's not legitimate and you should not provide that information.
And after all this, if a person who has tested positive is still not certain the person on the other end of the line is legit, what are some precautions that they can take?
Yeah, I mean, if you want some extra security, you know, these are city employees, so you can ask them to email you from an official city email address that's at phila.gov. So if that's an extra measure that will make you feel safe, you can ask them to do that. Or you can say, you know, I'm going to hang up and I'm going to call the city's coronavirus hotline directly just to make sure that this is real. So you can call the coronavirus hotline, which is 215-685-5488, and you can say, hey, I just got this contact tracing call from the city. I'm returning it. And then they'll connect you with an agent directly. So you'll know that way that you're talking to the city.
Okay. And the city is responding on another front to try to help contact tracers, these frontline workers. Digital feedback options. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the city's rolling out a few new sort of arms of this contact tracing department in the next few weeks. So the first one that they're working on right now is an online survey, which can be texted out to people who've tested positive for coronavirus. So, you know, a contact tracer can just text this link to anyone who they're trying to get in touch with, and it'll ask the same sort of questions that a contact tracer would ask in person, you know, where you've been, who your contacts have been, what date you tested positive. So that way they can limit the amount of those 20-minute interviews, like I said, that they're doing and save some time. And hopefully people will still respond to this survey. Some people might even be more inclined to respond if they don't like talking on the phone. So then the city can, you know, follow up on those contacts and make those calls based on the information you've entered. There's also going to be a new website. It's going to be like a portal where you can log on if you've tested positive and enter your contacts right into the website. And that way, again, the city can follow up on those and reach out to the contacts. So it's just kind of a few ways to, you know, manage the time of these contact tracers who just don't have enough resources to talk to everyone.
And also perhaps for those who test positive, the digital feedback options might prevent, or offer a sense of anonymity.
Sure.
Which might prompt them to participate.
Yeah, absolutely. That might make people more comfortable. And to be clear, you know, all of this is anonymous if that's a point of fear for anyone, even whether you talk on the phone or via these new digital options that are getting rolled out soon. They never tell the contacts that you were that case that may have exposed them, that you're always kept anonymous. So if you're worried about, I don't know, your friends being mad at you for potentially giving them coronavirus, you don't have to be. They won't find out it's you.
We've got a comment from Chad who says, I've disabled the contact tracing app on my iPhone because I feel it's too invasive with regard to privacy. I don't like the idea of my whereabouts being tracked. And, you know, I'm not sure if this is something you've heard about how the city government might be reacting to this, you know, as a possible hindrance in reaching out to people who test positive, people who are just checking out.
Sure,
are they saying
yeah.
anything about this, Michaela?
Well, I think privacy concerns are a big part of it. I mean, Denise talked about how she'll reach out to people for contact tracing, and they seem really skeptical because of this sort of phenomenon that's existed for a while of distrust in government. I think people are skeptical that they're not, you know, that they're giving their information to a legit source. And even if they are giving their information to a legit source, the city, it's like, what are they doing with that information? People get really antsy about things like that. Which makes sense, you know, but it is, it's for a good cause. It's to, you know, stop the spread of this virus.
When do the online tools go live?
They're expecting to roll those out at some point next week. You never know if that could be delayed on the city's end, but that's the plan for right now.
Michaela, the pressure to try to prevent community spread is increasingly intense, of course, as the city tries to avoid hospital, you know, the hospital overload that was experienced in the spring. What is Health Commissioner Thomas Farley asking of Philadelphians?
Sure. So last week, Farley does a briefing every Tuesday for the press, and he did what he usually does, which is really just beg residents to wear masks and not go to social gatherings. He's asking people to cancel their holiday plans for Thanksgiving, potentially even for the winter holidays, even small ones with friends or family. He's really concerned about this rapidly rising positivity rate that we're seeing in Philadelphia, and just asking people to stay home as much as they can and not meet up with other people.
And again, you know, the positivity rate on the rise by how much?
Well, we're at about a 13% positivity rate right now, which, to be clear, is higher than a lot of other major cities. And that is a fourfold increase from last month. So it's getting pretty serious.
The death rate is not as high as it was in the spring, Michaela. Are city officials still as concerned about hospital overload? What are you hearing here?
They're becoming concerned about hospitalizations, though Philly area hospitals have not yet reached capacity with coronavirus patients. That number of people hospitalized for the virus is increasing. State data shows that more than 375 COVID patients are hospitalized in the region compared to like 90 at the end of September. So we're seeing a rise here, and it's something that is on the mind of health officials 100%.
Yeah, still something to be taken very seriously. So Michaela Winberg, as we wrap up the segment, you mentioned a couple of important phone numbers earlier on. One was, if somebody is being contacted by a contact tracer and you're not sure that person is legit, there is a hotline. What is that number?
Sure. The city's coronavirus hotline is 215-685-5488.
And again, the number from the contact tracer, the first six digits are very specific to this job. What are those?
Sure. Those are 215-218. And then the last four digits can change depending on the extension of the employee. But 215-218 is what you want to look out for.
All right. Thanks for that important information, Michaela Winberg. As always, we appreciate your joining us here on the Regional Roundup.
Thank you, Mary.
Okay, Michaela reports for WHYY's Billy Penn. Up next, Philadelphia School Superintendent William Height. He'll talk about fluctuating school plans or school building opening plans as the number of COVID cases increase. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Coronavirus infections and hospitalizations are on the rise, and school districts are once again facing tough choices. The Policy Lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia is recommending that schools in the region resume virtual learning across the board, at least through December. And while many districts are weighing the next steps, the Philadelphia School District has already made a difficult decision in the face of the virus. The district has offered online learning only since the start of the school year, but had planned to bring very young children back to the classroom November 30th. That return has been scrapped, so virtual learning continues for all public school kids in Philly till further notice. As always, if you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number, 888-477-9499. Send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. Or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We now welcome Philadelphia School Superintendent William Height back to the Roundup to talk about the decision, also how things are going for the city's school children so far this year, and plans for future learning amid the uncertainty of the pandemic. William Height, good to have you with us again.
Good morning, Mary. Good to be here.
Good morning. So here we are in mid-November, with the virus still an enormous challenge. Describe the decision-making that went into canceling plans to bring kids in I think it was pre-K through second grade, back to brick-and-mortar buildings in a hybrid model. What went into that decision-making?
That's correct. And we made that decision last Tuesday, and it was a difficult determination. And it was to pause our plan to bring back, as you indicated, pre-K through second grade students back on November 30th. And that means that all of our students will continue with a 100% digital learning remotely until further notice. It also means we had subsequent plans for the phase-in of students with complex needs and some high schoolers and CTE, which is career and technical education, that has also been delayed for now. That was scheduled to happen in January.
Okay.
We are still determining if, in fact, we will be able to go forward with those plans.
So what were you hoping to gain by having children back in the physical classroom?
A couple of things. And first and foremost, for the youngest learners, we were hoping to gain the very important socialization with peers that are part of their growth and development that they unfortunately are not experiencing, or if they are experiencing, it's a remote experience. And while there's an extreme importance to teaching children to read and to do mathematics and to learn letters and words and vowels and all of those things, equally important is the socialization aspect that many of them have missed. And for our youngest learners, these are children who have not been in a school experience for the most part, particularly the pre-kindergartners and the kindergartners. And we had about 32,000 children in that cohort of pre-K through second grade, and about 10,000 were slated to come back on November 30th.
And also, William Height, Philadelphia, of course, has a high poverty rate, and poverty, can have a huge impact on learning. Have you found so far a significant difference in learning when you compare brick and mortar and virtual models, especially when it comes to kids who live below the poverty level?
Yeah, it's no doubt about it, Mary, that there is a disproportionate impact of this virus and of remote learning on children whose families are impacted with circumstances of poverty. And for many in our city, that means that's a large percentage of the populations we serve. In addition, we have children who are new to the country. We have children who are learning English. We have significant numbers of children with special needs. As I indicated before, our youngest learners. And so it's everything from the conditions for learning, particularly with many of their families either not having the appropriate technology or the appropriate access to the technology, to appropriate spaces in some cases for children to be in a quiet space to learn and to be able to pay attention. And as I indicated before, that critically important socialization part that is a part of their development is also being missed. And not only is it being missed at school because of the social distancing requirements and all that has been recommended throughout this pandemic, our young people haven't been able to socialize just with the casual socialization either. And so we are naturally concerned with that which is being lost as a part of the circumstances associated with the pandemic or responding to the pandemic.
At one point a few months ago, thousands of students still did not have access to computers, Wi-Fi, et cetera. Do they have that access now?
Yes, we are solving that problem, and we are gaining a large percentages of those young people are now gaining access both to the technology and to reliable high-speed internet. And We continue to let families know that if they still need reliable internet service, they can enroll in what's called PHL Connected. It is a program that is in partnership with the city, Comcast Foundation, the philanthropic community, and many others help support it. And it provides for up to 35,000 families here in the city of Philadelphia reliable high-speed internet. And all we ask individuals to do is call 211. It is a hotline that is manned by the United Way. It is open 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 150 languages, and press option one for more information and for the support that they may need. And it will provide individuals with either access code or a mobile hotspot that they could use to get connected to the internet. And so we have found that we have been able to enroll thousands of families in that program, and this program is available at no cost to the families, and there are no commitments for the families to continue the Wi-Fi service that then would become a paid service. And so we have that resource available, so we're finding that more and more of our families are utilizing that very important resource.
So how many are still without? And you know, are you concerned about them?
Of course. It's difficult to tell, Mary, for several reasons. One, we have those data are data that are available primarily through the internet service providers. And so we don't know who actually has the internet service or not. We estimated that we had some 18,000 children or families, at least within the school district, who did not have it. But since that time, we've been pushing out codes to over 10,000 individuals, and many have since signed up. And the other part of why it's so difficult is we don't know if individuals are using other resources in order to connect to the internet. And unfortunately, some of our high school students are still using cell phones to connect to get to their assignments. And the reason that also makes it difficult, we're seeing about a 90% attendance rate. And so children are finding ways to log on, but we want them to utilize this free service that has been made available for the families here in Philadelphia.
So it sounds that with virtual learning, as if there's a gap in being able to track down, get a hold, and you know, account for the kids who might not be in the system, as there would be if children were in brick and mortar schools and you could see who's there and who's not in the classroom. It sounds as if some kids are might be falling through the cracks.
Well, we have found that we have accounted for primarily all but about 2,000 of the young people that we had in previous years, and they may have enrolled in different schools, or they may have moved out of the area. And so we have seen a decline in about 2,000 children that we've been able to find. The prior question was, though, how many are able to connect to the internet? And while we've been able to find many of their children, it's still really important that we want to ensure that families are taking advantage of what we think is a significant resource with the PHL Connected. And we've learned from colleagues in other cities that have done this is that you have to keep reminding individuals that this service is available. We don't want people utilizing like the cell phone in order to enroll in classes when there is an opportunity to have access to high-speed, reliable internet.
One of the big concerns in the spring, William Height, with the abrupt shift to virtual learning was that many children did fall through the cracks and were falling behind in grade-level achievements. How is the effort to bring these kids back up to speed going? And are there concerns, you know, with the virtual system that's still in place, it's not ideal, that, you know, some of these older students, especially as they're getting close to graduation, are not going to be where they need to be?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the things that we have done, and we've learned a lot since the spring, and one thing that we learned is that we would have to do some sort of assessment to analyze where our young people are. given their age and their grade level. And so we have been busy this year, as the first part of the year, doing an assessment that we will actually repeat at least two or three more times to see where young people are. And we're doing that in kindergarten through 12th grade, as a matter of fact, in English language arts and in math. And we are able to then determine where young people are based on where they should be given their age and grade. And what we have found, Mary, is that this is very early data, so I don't want to draw any conclusions from this, but what we have found is that many of our young people, particularly in English language arts, are scoring where they typically would score given the first quarter of the year on a regular basis. It's a lot different in math, where children are behind, and which makes sense in terms of the sequential nature of math instruction and those types of things. But we are able to utilize those data and analyze those data to get the additional supports and resources to those young people, whether they're in schools or grade levels or certain parts of the city. So we're using that information to really construct the types of support structures that are going to be needed in order to provide children with the additional either time or activity or engagement to get them back to where they should be. But I will also add, Mary, that no matter the efforts here, nothing is going to be a sufficient replacement for face-to-face instruction. Yeah. And we can do, and our teachers have been doing a fabulous job of connecting and engaging with their young people, but it's not a sufficient replacement, nor will it likely ever be sufficient replacement for face-to-face instruction that happens between a teacher and their students.
Sure. Building safety is a big issue. There have been concerns about adequate ventilation in many buildings that have been around since before the 1980s. What remains to be done to ensure that COVID protocols are up to speed in brick-and-mortar buildings?
Yeah, thank you for that question. And we're continuing to do some significant work. And I think, as we've talked about on this show before, the amount of work that we've been able to do since our buildings have been closed. And we have tried to address and continue to address many of the environmental problems that have persisted in a district where the average age of buildings is well over 70 years old. And so we have, since we've been out in March, removed some 280,000 feet of asbestos-containing material. We've certified another 24 schools as lead safe, bringing the total to 110 schools. But with respect to COVID, we're actually doing ventilation assessments in addition to all of the other protocols that we have to put into place based on CDC guidelines and state health department guidelines. We're doing ventilation assessments in every space that would then house individuals once we return. And those ventilation assessments are based on the amount of fresh air that's being circulated either by a system or through having fresh air come into that space. And based on that, we are able to determine the occupancy that can be in that space. That's been completed for some 160 buildings already. And now with the delay, we feel like we can have that completed in all of the other facilities. And in some cases, make the repairs for individuals to address and correct that problem. In other places, those repairs are going to be more significant. And then we would have to utilize other short-term solutions like fans, window fans, mm-hmm. or other ways, or filters, other ways to ensure that fresh air is coming into a space.
Ideally, when is the reopening? You know, when does the reopening happen so that most, if not all, buildings are brought online and are safe as far as ventilation and even asbestos is concerned? When would the target be?
Yeah, we were ready to open back in the back in the fall. So we were ideally we were ready to open back in the fall. This not opening has given us the opportunity to really do get in and do a lot of work. The work that we're going to be doing around lead paint and asbestos will continue simply because of the age of our buildings and the amount of work that needs to happen. And we are addressing, naturally, we're addressing those areas that we call imminent hazards. But by the same token, in order to ensure that all buildings will be lead safe and asbestos safe, it's going to require a lot more work over a period of time. But to your question, we'll have the ventilation assessments completed now by the middle of this month. Mm-hmm. And so, which are the last part of what we need to do in order to make sure buildings are safe for individuals to meet the COVID guidelines. But to your point, I don't have an estimate of when we can get back in. As your last guest indicated, with the case counts now where they are, and we base that on two factors, the average per 100,000 people. And as was indicated earlier last week, that had gone over 164 per 100,000. And the state and the city would like to see that number at 100. Since then, Mary, that number is at 270 per 100,000. Yeah. And now our case counts are well over 12%. So we don't know when, and we're going to be guided and continue to be guided by the science and the recommendations from the health officials. And so hopefully that will be sometime soon. Maybe a vaccine becomes available. Maybe we have testing protocols in place. But the sooner we can get back, the better for our young people.
Yeah, a lot of I'm sure a lot of people agree with you, and all sorts of factors in play. So stay tuned, as we say, right?
Indeed.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're up against the clock, but Philadelphia School Superintendent William Hite, as always, a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Mary. Thank you.
All right. And up next on the Regional Roundup, we're joined by Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist Marcus Hayes. We'll talk about the Eagles game on Sunday, Eagles Giants, and what their prospects are in the rather awful NFC East coming up. Stick around. This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are just past the midpoint of the regular football season, and the Eagles somehow remain in first place in the NFC East with a 3-5-1 record. By now, many of us who follow sports know the NFC East is a terrible division, but whoever ends up in the top spot will get to the playoffs, no matter if they have a losing record. It doesn't look great for the Birds at this point. They lost to the Giants on Sunday, and the road ahead includes the Seahawks, Packers, and the Saints. We'll be talking about whether the Eagles can somehow pull off a playoff run this year, and we'll check in on what's happening with Philly's other pro sports teams as well with Marcus Hayes. He joins us once again. Marcus, a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Hello, welcome back.
Good morning. I'm glad to be back.
Well, okay, Sunday's game, 27-17 loss to the Giants. The Eagles are simply outplayed, to be kind. What is going on, Marcus?
Well, there are a couple of things at play. Number one, last week when the Giants played the Washington football team, everybody was sort of astounded at what a good game it was. Not because two bad teams were playing bad football and it was close, but because both of those teams got appreciably better. And the Giants, if you remember, 3 weeks ago, had the Eagles beat. There was a dropped pass. It wasn't an easy catch by Evan Engram, but it was a dropped pass that kept the Eagles sort of within striking distance. And they, you know, to their credit, they came back and won. And the assumption was the Eagles would be appreciably better coming out of their bye 3 weeks later, because they would get Lane Johnson, Miles Sanders, and Alshon Jeffrey back at least. They got them all back. Lane Johnson and Miles Sanders played very, very well, but the rest of the team didn't. Yeah. But the biggest issue wasn't that the Eagles were very, very bad. The thing they did worst was they had 11 penalties, and the second worst thing they did is they were 0-9 on third down. But the Giants were better. You know, they had 11 penalties because the Giants played well. They were 0-9 because the Giants' defense is a pretty good defense at this point.
Yeah. Well, you know, it just struck me, you know, at one point, there are a number of things happened in the game, obviously, but, you know, Jason Kelce, for instance, offered up a bunch of low shotgun snaps. And, but you know what? I just felt as if the team had given up in some fashion. When I saw that, I thought, what's going on?
Well, here's the thing, and I don't blame you for thinking that. I have never seen a Doug Peterson team give up, and I don't think we saw that on Sunday either. I think the team is bewildered. Like, they don't understand why what was working over the last 4 years, and even his first season at 7-9 was relatively successful with an up-and-coming quarterback in Carson Wentz. But they're baffled that things that used to work aren't working. Things that used to seem easy aren't easy anymore. I can't explain 6 bad snaps, bad shotgun snaps by the best center in the history of the franchise of the modern era. You know, God bless Chuck Bednarik. But that's the sort of thing that happens. And covering sports in Philadelphia, and especially covering the Eagles, when a team is playing below the level they should be playing, that's the sort of phenomena that happens. Something weird like that. Like, the defense will have 17 false starts in 5 weeks or something like that. Or the center will start hitting himself in the calf with long snaps. And it becomes like a phenomenon. It becomes something that repeats over and over again. So, yeah, I don't think they gave up. I think they played pretty hard. But I think they kind of chased their own tails. They've chased their own tails frequently the last 2 seasons.
Maybe a bewilderment virus. No. Anyway,
perhaps,
let's get to Carson Wentz. You know, one of his greatest challenges this season has been turnovers. He didn't have any yesterday. But as you wrote last week, he's a 5-year starter playing like a 5-week rookie. You know, at times it seems as if Coach Doug Peterson might be warming up to the idea of letting rookie Jalen Hurts start at quarterback. He's been playing here and there in different positions on the offense. Do you think we're getting to that point?
Well, I did 24 hours ago. I thought that this was probably the make or break game for Carson Wentz, because entering the bye and exiting the bye, Doug Peterson was very lukewarm in his endorsement of Carson Wentz. Carson Wentz played pretty well compared to the way he played in the first 8 games in the 9th game. So I think he probably saved his job to some degree. I think had Carson Wentz turned the ball over 2 more times, he was averaging 2 turnovers per game entering the bye and entering yesterday. He didn't turn the ball over. He threw the ball away a couple of times. He didn't take any bad sacks that I saw. So it was a big step forward for Carson Wentz in that he didn't put them in a position to lose. He didn't actively position them to lose the game, which is not a ringing endorsement of a quarterback who's on, you know, in the first year of a $128 million contract with $100 million guaranteed, or a guy who's been to a Pro Bowl, was an MVP candidate, and is in his 5th season. But I think he did more than enough to retain his position, especially as they enter this stretch. You alluded to it earlier. You know, they've got the Browns, who are a pretty good team, next in Cleveland. And I don't know that the road makes a big difference. But then, as you said, you have the Seahawks,
the Saints, and the Packers.
The Packers, whose name I wrote so badly on my paper here that I couldn't read it. And the Cardinals, who won a thriller last night and have probably the most exciting young player in the league in Kyler Murray, who's the type of quarterback that gives the Eagles fits, a mobile quarterback with a big arm. So, yeah, this is honestly, they could win 2 more games and win the division. That's how bad the division is. And the other teams in the division have to play largely the same group of very, very good teams. And they play each other. But if the Eagles win the rest of their divisional games, they have a very good chance of being the first 5-win playoff team.
However, at the same time, you did say in I think it was this morning's article that was published, that you thought the 3-7 Giants are the best team.
They are. At this point, they are a better team than the Eagles. But the Eagles have more players, you know, set to return in the near future, one of whom is Isaac Seumalo, and they had a huge issue on their offensive line yesterday. But more than anything else, I mean, to talk this long about the Eagles and not mention the words Zach or Ertz is remarkable. Zach Ertz was Carson Wentz's favorite weapon. He's been their best, their most dynamic and best offensive player consistently for the last 5 years. This would be like not mentioning, I don't know, Tony Gonzalez and talking about the Chiefs. That's how important Zach Ertz is to the Eagles. And that doesn't mean Zach Ertz is going to the Hall of Fame, but he's the best tight end they've ever had. And it's not close. He's one of the maybe top 10 offensive players they've ever had, and they've been without him for 3 or 4 weeks now. If they get him back and he's healthy and effective, I know he wasn't having a great season before, but he did attract attention, and they like to play two tight ends a lot. And with him and Dallas Goedert, the third-year guy, on the field at the same time, it's a big difference.
All right. Well, Eagles fans are feeling a tad better with those thoughts, Marcus. All right. So, but very quickly, do we write Dallas off? And how about the Washington team?
Well, I don't think either of those teams are the caliber of the Giants, which is, again, hilarious to say because the Giants have 3 wins and a quarterback who's second in the league in turnovers behind Carson Wentz. But the Giants are you know, entering a bye, and they're the number one team with a bullet in the NFC East. Both Washington and Dallas are better now than when the Eagles faced them the first time. So, no, you don't write them off.
The NFL playoffs have been expanded once for this go-round. They could expand again. Owners say the playoffs will go from 14 to 16 teams if the pandemic forces the league to cancel games. You know, the playoffs this year were already expanded from 12 to 14. What is the immediate effect here? It feels a little weird to have so many in the playoffs.
Yeah.
A little watered down.
It used to be that, you know, baseball and football would give you more of a real playoff, more of a real reward for being the best team during the regular season. I've never been a huge proponent of the bye. The bye is just a gigantic, gigantic benefit, especially, obviously, after 16 games. Eradicating the bye, for me, would make the playoffs a little bit more interesting, actually, because you would find out who the better team really is. I mean, the advantage of getting a week off between the end of the regular season and the start of your playoffs, and often it's 2 weeks off. If you're a really, really good team, you don't have to play your starters in the 16th game. So in effect, you get 2 weeks off, 2 weeks to heal, 2 weeks for guys with nagging injuries to get healthy. I don't mind expanded playoffs because of that reason, but you know, there is. I understand the other side of the argument where sustained excellence should be rewarded.
Let's get to the NBA, the virtual draft, I think, set for just a couple days from now. And as I understand it, Marcus, the 2020-21 season begins December 22nd, 72 games. I think it's usually 82. Do we know yet how games will be played? Will the bubble be back?
I don't think the bubble will be back. But I believe that there will be virtual bubbles for most teams. In talking to virologists and epidemiologists at the beginning of the outbreak, the concern, the sport with which they were most concerned was basketball, because they practice and play in such proximity to each other that droplet exchange is inevitable. So I think I've been actually astounded at how few complications were encountered in the NFL, which is much more, you know, close contact than Major League Baseball, which, you know, have the biggest idiots in sports. I mean, the baseball players are just, you just can't, there's no structure to their lives. Yeah. So baseball, I expected to struggle the way they did early, and then they got it together and entered a playoff bubble. All that said, I think basketball players were really, really good, because again, they're kind of knuckleheady compared to football players and certainly compared to hockey players. Giving them their freedom and asking them to be disciplined, I think, will go better than most people expect.
Okay.
But I expect there to be a bubble at least by, I'd say, Valentine's Day, because you're going to have knuckleheads do knucklehead things. You're going to have games postponed. And I don't expect there to be a full 72-game season. I think 60 is a more realistic option.
Okay. Sixers are unveiling a new uniform, back to black, but with a twist. Philly's Boathouse Row. Although the word Philly, somehow Chris Heck, president of business operations, kind of stepped in it last week.
Well, Chris is, I know, I've known Chris for several years, and he's sort of emblematic of the organization. They're generally pretty good people who aren't particularly attuned to the heartbeat of Philadelphia, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, and we should explain, too, by the way, Marcus, I'm being a little cryptic here for people who don't know. He took issue with using the word Philly, I guess, in association with the Sixers, as opposed to the word New Philadelphia, because Philly was a little too blue-collar, if I've gotten that right. And he got a lot of negative response. Yeah. Yeah, they're not the Flyers. The Flyers took issue with that, too, right?
Yeah. It's funny. The Flyers celebrated their, you know, blue collar nature by posting a picture of a bloody player saying, yeah, we're Philly. Thank you very much. But again, you know, he was trying to tout Philly as being more than blue collar by insulting the people who consider themselves blue collar. And honestly, Chris is right. Philadelphia is a white collar city. Philadelphia is a white collar of pretty much any city, you know, outside of maybe Seattle, San Francisco, and Boston. However, Philadelphians believe that everybody's rocky and they're going to be, you know, overcome this underdog phenomenon, when the reality is, you know, 100 years ago, being a Philadelphia lawyer meant you were highfalutin, and Philadelphia cream cheese was named because it wanted to be the fanciest cream cheese. So, you know, the reality is, Chris is right. The practicality is, Chris did said a dumb thing, apologized, yeah. And I guess we're going to move on from that. But it was fun to watch. It's always fun to watch executives squirm a little bit. And knowing Chris and knowing the, you know, kind of the pureness of his heart, it was fun to watch that.
Oh, well, Philadelphia is many things, arts and culture and sports and much more, obviously. Hey, just quickly, do you like the uniform?
Oh, God, no.
No.
I'm very much a traditionalist. I would take all names off the back of uniforms. I would have only the actual insignia, not Sixers, 76ers. I would, you know, football uniforms, all of them. I love Penn State's uniforms. You know, I love classic looking uniforms. I understand the necessity to drive revenue with marketing and different versions of whatever. And, you know, you're attracting a different audience. But my personal taste is, you know, less is more.
Fair enough. All right. So quickly, since, of course, we're up against the clock, as always, Flyers might have a new jersey on the way as well. What that is remains to be seen. What's the latest on when the NHL season begins and how might it look?
I think the NHL season will be a little bit more buttoned down than the NBA season. I wouldn't be surprised to see the local bubbles. I wouldn't be surprised to see, you know, it last a little bit longer. The NHL has been really exemplary for a long time in a lot of different areas. So I'm much more optimistic to see the NHL play all its games because the culture of the league, the aura of the sport is much more appreciative that they get to play the sport. So they'll do whatever they need to do to lock it down.
And Marcus, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the union, which after 13 years of existence has won what's called the Supporters Shield, given to the team with the best regular season record. You know, normally the union aren't really front page news. Are they, after all this time, elbowing their way into the hearts and minds of Philly fans?
Well, look, I'm a soccer fan. My family's are soccer fans. I was a soccer player. We go to union games. We buy union gear. We're still the fringe. I know Jim Curtin. I'm so happy for him, a local guy succeeding with the local team. The union has done it right. They homegrew their players, and they didn't overpay for superstars. That said, the reality is they are the stepchild in town. But they probably have the best fan base, the most knowledgeable fan base, and the most loyal fan base. So God bless them. I mean, I remember years ago when the union was sort of trying to get a foothold, Comcast Sportsnet was very, very instrumental in promoting them, and we were part of that.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, but we'll have to continue this conversation next time. Marcus, thanks so much. Great to have you with us, as always.
My pleasure.
Marcus Hayes is sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This reminder, we're here on social media. You can find us at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producer is John Ahrens. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us, and be well.